Okay, this is talking with Ivan Polini-Toth at Grenoble on 31st August, 76. Now, can you tell me just what your background was before you joined the Cambridge group?
Oh, well, I was an undergraduate at Cambridge.
Oh, I see.
For 3 years.
In physics?
Well, natural sciences, physics in the final year, yes.
And how was it that you decided you wanted to get into radio astronomy?
Well, in fact, it was a second choice.
Oh, I see.
Like so many people at the time, I was more interested in nuclear physics, but I was also interested in astronomy and radio techniques. And in fact, I was offered a research studentship with Martin Rouse Group, so.
Right.
I went into that role.
Right. And what year was that?
59. Yes. 59.
And how was it decided what you would work on? Were you sort of assigned to
That was more or less assigned. Most of the people who went there for a few months just spent helping other people, I think. So I helped setting up the 408 megahertz 3C antenna, which was being made at 408 megahertz at the time. And but the topic of my work, which was galactic radiation, background emission, was in fact set.
Right.
Martin Ryle and Graham Smith. So essentially, all that time I was working on galactic background emission and polarization.
Now, what was the purpose of converting the 3C aerial to 408?
Well, it was intended to do another survey, like the 3C survey, at 408 megahertz. But in fact, that data never appeared.
Why is that?
I'm not sure. I think the reason was mainly sensitivity, but it was not a very useful survey. So the thesis came out of it, but...
whose thesis was that?
That was Hazlett, John Hazlett. He's in fact left, I think, left radio astronomy after that. So all that came out was his thesis and privately circulating list of sources. But, so the things that I call LHE.
LHE?
Long, Hazlett, and Elsmore, I guess.
I see. Was this designed to be a full, something that might be 4C then, at that time?
It would have been something more like 3C because, it wasn't a very sensitive antenna.
Right.
Receivers weren't very good. But, no, this was independent of 4C because at the time the 4C aerial was already coming into operation, essentially.
But what I meant was that it could have gotten the number 4C, and 4C might have gotten 5C if this had worked. Yeah. So you got into galactic background work, and what were the problems at that time? What was trying to be understood?
The main idea was to produce a survey which was accurately calibrated. In other words, we were trying to measure absolute brightness temperatures, not simply to produce enough in the sky. So it was to a large extent technical, not so much scientific. Building receivers and reference loads, finding out how to do good calibrations at what was then a fairly high frequency, 75
wavelength. Right. Had anyone ever done any calibrated background surveys at any frequencies before?
At the lower frequencies, there were already some experiments made with scaled aerials. Costain and Turtle. Tony Turtle was involved. Various other people, Shake Shack. So this was part of the same series, as it were. One wanted a higher frequency point on the spectrum for the background. And I'm told this was quite useful.
No,
didn't stay in the field after leaving.
No, what was the ultimate objective after you had an accurate spectrum as a function of position on the sky?
Well, to find out whether there were any changes in the spectrum of galactic coordinates or with various features in the galactic background, the spurs of emission and so forth. And in fact, later, I forget the name, it's a Yugoslav woman, made measurements with the Double Bank Telescope, which happens to have the same beamwidth at 38 megahertz as my survey had 408 megahertz, so she was able to produce a scale map at a very low frequency and get a spectral index distribution.
What about the question of the halo? Was that being debated at that time?
That was also debated, and I'm not sure these particular observations helped too much with that. They're certainly consistent with the presence of a halo.
But the frequency was too high, really, to...
The problem is that the existence of all these spurs of emission, which tend to spoil a nice uniform picture, you have to subtract them out, and the results are a bit uncertain.
When you began, in particular, was there any doubt about the origin of the background emission? I mean, namely, did everybody accept that it was synchrotron at that time?
Yes. Well, so the test was to look for polarization, which we and the Dutch and Leiden did more or less at the same time. Now, we had a much larger beam, so it wasn't absolutely clear that we detected it, whereas there with a small beam, we're pretty confident about it.
I mean, you had depolarization because of different angles.
That's right, We had a 7-8 degree beam, something like that.
I see. Yeah.
They had one which was a couple of degrees, I think. In fact, there was some weak polarization there, even without beam. Richard Wielobinski then went on after me to map the whole sky polarization.
And was this Dutch detection the first detection of the galactic background?
Of the polarization.
Yes, the polarization. Yes, right. And that was what year about? 62?
Oh, 62, yes.
What about this? There's a paper by Raisin in 58 or something, that I think a Russian that claims polarization. Do you know about that?
It rings a bell, but I'm not.
Yeah. I'm trying to.
I think that was even a lower frequency. I'm not sure if that was real or.
But I'm trying to see if you believed that report at that time, and were trying to confirm it, or whether you were just saying no one has detected polarization.
Well, there were other attempts made at Cambridge also before that time at lower frequencies by Thompson, I think, who didn't really find anything. So it wasn't clear whether this was at 150 megahertz. It wasn't clear whether there would be anything or not, but. If there was, it would be another confirmation of the synchrotron mechanism for the galactic background radiation. So the Dutch results, our results certainly helped.
Right. But you say another confirmation. What was really the evidence that the background was synchrotron before you had polarization?
I suppose only the spectrum, that it was similar to the spectrum of radio sources in general.
Well, also, that if you took this known spectrum of cosmic rays,
then you could
that you
you
got
could fit,
a,
that's
a,
right.
a similar spectrum. You predicted the right spectrum in the radio. Yeah. The reason I'm asking, in the CRAB, you had optical and radio polarization,
right.
So you could accept it in a supernova run anyway.
Yeah.
And I guess it was being accepted in even extragalactic radio sources.
Yes.
And what would be the why would people be doing that? Would it be just because they didn't have anything better, or would there be any direct evidence besides the spectrum again?
Doing what?
In extragalactic radio sources. Were people saying that those two were primarily synchrotron radiation at this time?
Yes, I think it was pretty well accepted at the time. I'm not sure now. Apart from the supernovae, whether there was any evidence for, say, polarization.
I don't think so in 1960
fact,
or...
Later.
Well, in fact, the first one was on the Parkes dish, wasn't it? Was it Centaurus?
Yeah.
I think that was 62 or 3. That was just about this time.
Right.
And so, when did you get your degree at Cambridge?
In 62.
Before we go beyond that, I'd be interested in your comments on the nature of working in the Cambridge group.
The fact that I wasn't involved in the source work, 4C and 3C and so on.
Right.
That was really where the main effort of Raz group went, in the source counts and
right.
so forth. And these background measurements that Ryle himself didn't take an enormous interest in. And he was interested, but
right.
It wasn't the prime aim at the time.
I see.
So we were not really involved in the controversies between Ryle and Mills and Ryle and Hoyle. And
right.
So it was interesting working there.
You were out of the mainstream, you're saying, mostly Cambridge work. Who was your advisor?
Graham Smith, most of the time, and Shakeshaft also, quite a while.
At this time, there used to be these Saturday morning sessions. Were they still on when you were there?
That's right.
Did these allow you to keep up more or less with what was going on with all the source count stuff and so forth?
Yes. Also the fact that space was limited, so then one's sharing rooms with other people who were working with these
fields. Yeah. So everybody knew what everybody was doing, essentially.
Right, yes.
So where did you go from Cambridge then?
To an area, to Green Bank.
And what was the attraction to go to Green Bank in 1962?
Well, in 1962, the 300 foot was just nearing completion. In fact, in the autumn of that year, it came into operation. The 140 foot was still a shell, pedestal essentially. And honestly, Martin Ryle himself was a bit skeptical about an RAO, but it sounded like an interesting place to go to, at least for a while, and that was my intention, to go for a year or two and see what happened. It ended up that I stayed 8 years. But it was really a choice between that or Australia. I had also talked to Bernie Mills, and there was a possibility of going there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, not Bernie Mills, Pawsey was at that time, CSIRO.
Right.
Then it turned out that Pawsey, in fact, was to go to an RAO and be director there, which was nice. He'd been really inclined in the direction of an RAO. But then, of course, he died soon after that, so...
So then Otto Struve became head, is that right? Or was that when Heeshan became head?
Heeshan became head. In fact, he became acting head, I think, in 62. And then...
That's right. Struve was the one that Pawsey was to replace.
Right. So when I got to an RAO, Struve wasn't there anymore.
So when you arrive on the scene at Green Bank, what can one do with this? I guess the 300 foot is the main.
The 300. Thing. Well, there was already the 85 foot, the
right.
tape telescope, and the decision was made in a strange way. We had a big meeting, the Heeshan presiding, and outlined a number of fields in which one could work with the 300 foot. Were the obvious things one could do.
This was the whole staff. Of
yes. And one was, for example, to measure the spectra of three C sources at higher frequencies. And there were a number of other things, and I and Cam Wade and Dave Heeshan, in fact, picked this particular field as to work on.
I see.
So in the fall of 1962, in fact, began observations on...
How many people were on the staff? How many people were around this table at this meeting?
Not very many. Must have been a dozen or so.
What were some of the other projects that were talked about?
There was a survey which Bertil Haugland was involved in, a strip of sky survey at 21 centimeters and 7 and 40 centimeters. There were galaxies which Cam Wade and Dave Heeshan, normal galaxies.
Right.
Planetary work, Frank Drake was interested in Venus, and I think it was mainly Venus, Jupiter maybe. There might have been one or two other things.
I know that Burke and Tuve came in for H1 work.
That's right. That was a bit later, I think.
They were not on the staff.
No.
It seems like the staff had much more percentage of time on the telescope then, is that right?
In the beginning, certainly. In fact, this meeting, I suppose, sort of skimmed the cream of what could be done with a 300 foot.
But no one took H1 on the staff.
Not at that time. Mort Roberts
My memory is failing. I'm not sure if he was there already. He must have been, I guess. I'm sorry.
I can't remember. I talked to him a couple years ago.
Well, the other we did have a project on the 85 book with Dave Ho, which began. Well, it was an extension of what I'd been doing in Cambridge. That we were going to use the 85 foot to measure polarization at high frequencies at 750 megahertz. And in fact, BID designed the equipment for it and did a lot of observation. But that's something that never got published.
I see. Any particular reason?
Well, I was fairly busy with the 300 from work. Then work began on the interferometer. Dave was involved in that, building up the interferometer. And somehow the pressure of these other things, and then the 140 foot coming in.
Right.
And we got the results to a fairly advanced stage, produced maps of polarization and background. But that's as far as we got. And some years later, we decided maybe we should do something with it, looked at the data. Some of the basic data about calibration we either didn't remember or hadn't done, so the data was privately circulated to other people who were interested, but never got published.
Were there any problems in using the 300 foot in those first couple of years?
Well, the receivers weren't very good. We started out with mixers. And gradually things improved. After a year or so, in 63, we had faramps on the telescope, tunnel diodes at 70 megahertz. No particular problems. We recorded data on paper tape rather than magnetic tape. Well, I suppose one of the problems was that the 3CR survey as such hadn't appeared in print at the time. At least it hadn't reached us. So we had 3C positions. And it was necessary to hunt for the sources not only at the given position but also in the lobes, the lobe-shifted positions.
Right.
So this made work take longer than it otherwise would have. On the other hand, it meant that one picked up a number of other sources, some of which have since become interesting.
What would be your assessment of the 300-foot as an instrument in terms of cost-effectiveness and so forth?
Well, I think it's a very good investment. I don't know, the price was $1 million or so. And it produced a lot of good results in the early years. And after the resurfacing, it's had a very long life.
It still is. Now, about the 140 foot, were you involved at all in any aspects of the building of that?
No. Not at all, in fact. I simply waited and hoped that it would come. And in fact, it took a long time. It was 65 by the time it was operational. And in fact, the problems with the 140 foot were more severe than with the 300 foot in the early days, pointing problems in particular.
Well, before we get to that, there's a story which no one has told me officially, but I heard someone mention that somebody was killed in the construction of the 300 foot, or almost, the 140 foot, is this right, the crane? Do you know about this?
No, I don't. They had a near accident.
Yeah, it was a near accident.
A near accident when they were lifting the backup structure.
And the crane, yes.
The cable broke. It wasn't a cable which was bearing the weight, but a cable which held it sort of in a vertical position, pointing at the horizon. And this broke, and the structure started swinging, but fortunately the crane operator had the presence of mind to quickly lower it, so it hit the ground, the lower edge, but not with any great force. It stopped tilting.
And what exactly was he lifting now?
The whole backup structure. The panels were not on, but the backup structure was complete. The feed legs were not on yet.
I see.
The whole of the support structure came down. And it could have, I suppose, been a serious accident.
That's the one I hear. So it came into operation. When did you have first access to it to try calibrations?
Around July, August 65. I believe. In fact, there wasn't any real calibration period. This was very different later with the Bond telescope, for example, but essentially people started observing immediately.
I see.
and in particular Metzger and Hoagland with the recombination lines.
Right.
And there were a lot of problems with the pointing and the, well, the receiver too. Ken Kellerman and I also started around about then measuring sources at 6 centimeters. But really useful results, I would say, didn't begin to come out till later in the year, fall of 65.
And what were the problems with the pointing? I mean, were there something that were not expected?
I guess it was unexpected. The pointing was variable by 1 or 2 minutes of arc, which even at 6 centimeters is an appreciable fraction of the beam width. So one had to be very careful about measuring calibration sources. And some of that problem is still there even now.
But are you saying it's not repeatable, or?
It wasn't repeatable, no. I'm not sure anymore what the early problems were. I think the early problems had to do with the encoder systems. And these were repaired, fixed, but there are still, even now, some thermal effects, which means that the pointing can change by 30 seconds of arc or so.
Right.
Which is awkward at the high frequencies.
Looking at the 140 foot as a whole, would you say that, I mean, it's the largest equatorially mounted radio telescope, and it's been criticized for its, you know, sort of massive structure and so forth. Do you have any opinion as to how this came about?
The massive structure?
Well, or the idea of making an equatorial unit.
I think the main reason was that some lack of confidence in computers required to do the coordinate transformation. And in fact, the Parkes telescope, which is an Althaus telescope, came into operation at a not very different time.
Well, 62 or 3, which is when the 140 foot was originally intended for, I think.
But I suppose having decided on a equatorial design, it would have been just too much work and expense to change over to an Althausimuth. I imagine they would have had to rebuild the whole pedestal.
Sure.
Just change everything. It's a bad design. Well, not only mechanically, but if you want to calibrate high frequencies, fluxes in particular, you don't know. You have to assume that the gain of the telescope varies, say, with elevation. This is not necessarily true.
Right.
So it's very hard to get a consistent flux density scale at the high frequencies.
Right.
And say at 2 centimeters, and even now, I don't think one knows exactly what the calibration curve is.
10 years later.
In all orientations, that's right.
Mm. Well, that about does it as far as I'm going. Any other comments you'd like to make about the early days at NREO? How was that group different from being at Cambridge? Maybe you could tell me.
Oh, I think a lot more freedom of choice in what you want to do. There wasn't a definite aim for the observatory there.
Mm-hmm.
There were all kinds of people doing different things, and one was free to pick what one wanted to do. I could have, for example, done interferometry instead of flux measurements if I had wanted to, or line work.
Yeah. On the other hand, were there any review of papers by Heeshan or anyone else? Other than some colleague that must be interested. In other words, I'm trying to see if there any check on the quality of the scientific results that are coming out other than the author's own standards.
Oh, he was certainly interested in what one was doing and would look at what was coming out.
But, I mean, essentially, was there a veto power over? Or almost a veto power over things that are said in papers where you could get tossed back to you. And
if you really disagreed with something, then you would say so, but...
Yeah.
Well, I haven't run across anything like that myself.
Yeah. And as far as the future of NREO in the early 60s, what were people thinking was going to be the way to go?
Well, there was a a strong interest in interferometry. Pawsey, had he been director, would certainly have pushed in that direction. He was interested in aperture synthesis methods and building up a large aperture synthesis instrument.
I see. So, that's interesting. I hadn't realized that specifically before.
In fact, when we were corresponding when I was still in Cambridge, he wanted me to find out just what the situation was in Cambridge and what mm-hmm. developments would be in the future. So I think it would have gone in a similar direction, maybe not the VLA, but
yeah.
an instrument, maybe of a decibel type.
Right, or the 1 mile or something.
Well, yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, that ends the interview with Pliny Toth on 31st August 76.